COVID-19 has changed everything, halting life as we know it in its tracks. To respond to this global pandemic and to adapt to this new way of life, we're doing things a bit more DIY than usual. We're not in the studio and we're dispersed all over the country, but we did want to respond to the urgent need for information, bringing to you the voices of some of the leading experts to help us grapple with the new and not so new dimensions of this crisis. It's in this vein that we're calling the series Under the Black Light, to uncover the conditions that pre-existed the virus and the cracks in our social structure that the virus can now exploit to wreak maximum havoc. In the coming weeks, we'll be producing live conversations that bring together artists, activists, thought leaders, scholars, service providers, and others on the front lines of the fight against COVID-19. Each Wednesday, we'll bring you a virtual conversation over Zoom, which will then be released as an episode of Intersectionality Matters in the following week. This conversation brought together five panelists: Bree Newsom, Paul Butler, Jonathan Metzl, Barbara Arnwine, and Kehinde Andrews. Full bios are available at our website, aapf.org. So let's dive right in. Paul, I wonder if you would share some of the snapshots from the interaction between COVID, racialized policing, and mass incarceration in the U.S.
The first snapshot is of my hometown, Chicago, and it's 1918. 1918 is the only year from 1900 to 1999 that African Americans didn't disproportionately die of the flu. The Spanish flu proportionally killed more white people than African Americans. But why is that? You know, they tried to blame our bodies. They said it had to do with the thickness of our noses. And we know that's ridiculous, because if that were the explanation, why would African Americans disproportionately die of respiratory illnesses other times? They tried to blame the Great Migration. Again, white supremacy has its own logic. The answer is always to blame Black people. The solution is always to blame people of color. And even though at the time it was known that African Americans were less likely to die of the disease, they still tried to blame us for bringing it. They blamed the Great Migration. The Chicago Tribune, it had a headline, "Negroes Swarm to the North," and that's what brought this disease. And so one explanation for why Blacks were less likely to get the Spanish flu is because there were two forms of it, two versions. There was the mild version in the spring, and there was the more lethal version in the fall. And the theory is, for the reasons we all could imagine, that Blacks were more likely to get it in the spring when it was less lethal. And so by the time the deadly version came along in the fall, many Blacks had developed resistance, had developed immunity. We also see the power of the state. What the city of Chicago did was to deputize nurses, to give them police authority to enter people's homes to see if they had the flu, even without their will. That's 1918. The quick fast forward, we can stay in Chicago for a moment. We can go to the Cook County Jail, one of the largest clusters of the coronavirus in the country. It should be one of the largest providers of services, but it is not providing those services. It cannot provide those services. And the people who are in there are essentially sentenced to death. And the other snapshot is of a public transportation, a bus in Philly. A Black man is violently removed from the bus because he's not wearing a mask. Contrast that with Nashville in a Walmart, and the police officer forcibly removes two Black men because they are wearing masks.
Thank you, Paul, for that snapshot. I'm going to move for another snapshot to Bree. So Bree, you're in Raleigh, North Carolina. I want to ask you to describe the scene for us there. What in particular is drawing your attention as COVID marches through dispossessed communities there?
In my view as an organizer, and I think certainly in the views of people who are, you know, living in dispossessed communities, is that we were in a crisis situation before the COVID outbreak, right? And that's because the status quo, or what, you know, a lot of people identify as normal when they are calling for us to, you know, get back to normal or reopen the country, which has become the other buzzword, the normal times were a disaster, right? And so I think that's really important to understand. And it is that disastrous status quo that laid the groundwork for COVID-19 outbreak in the United States to be so much worse. You know, the lack of access to housing. I mean, we had a housing crisis going on in North Carolina, as of course, as you know, we're seeing across the country, where people are, you know, working full-time jobs in some cases and still can't afford, you know, to find safe, stable, a consistent place to live. We have people who are working two jobs and still don't have access to affordable health care, right? So those are all of the things that are already baked into our infrastructure that then when we have a what is a public health crisis, because our system is so organized fundamentally around white supremacy and around the workforce that is now being labeled essential, is not able to make a pivot to a public health response, right? So the status quo is exactly what Paul was speaking to. It's policing and prisons and violence. And so then when we have an outbreak, instead of the response being, you know, how do we make sure that everyone who needs to shelter in place can shelter in place, instead of making sure that everyone who needs a mask has a mask, a lot of the focus is going back to maintaining a status quo of racial violence. And that status quo has always treated essential workers as disposable. And I mean, I think that is very important to recognize, even from the earliest days of the slave colonies. You know, slaves were both an essential labor force and were also highly disposable, because the dehumanization of that labor force is an essential part of how the whole economy is maintained. This economy that people are eager to get back to, this economy that is consistently prioritized above human life.
So you mentioned the housing crisis as one, you know, point of inflection. How is it being manifest in the way COVID enforcement is playing out in Raleigh?
So I think it's so important for people to understand that a significant segment of our population, including myself at one point, are caught in a cycle of housing instability. So a lot of times people think homeless means, you know, strictly I'm sleeping on a park bench, or, you know, I have absolutely nowhere to go tonight, right? The reality is that there are some people who are in that position, but a lot of people are just caught in a cycle where maybe they can make rent this month, but not next month. And we know that's hitting a lot of people, a lot more people now. So we had, prior to the COVID outbreak, people who were caught in that cycle. And now we have people who, before the outbreak, were kind of in a stable situation, and now they're falling into the cycle of housing instability. So here in North Carolina, you know, we have a situation where we had to, first of all, push the governor to put, you know, a stay in place order, you know, statewide in place. But even once that is in place, that doesn't mean everyone has a place to go. And people who do have a place to go, doesn't mean that they can afford the rent to stay there, right? And it just highlights what housing advocates like myself have been saying for a long time, which is that housing is a fundamental public health issue. And it's actually square one in terms of having health and stability. And when we have a system that is so organized around inequality and ensuring, like by design, to guarantee that people are unequal in their outcomes, and that, you know, where you live kind of determines your health and longevity, what we find is that it lowers the quality of life for everyone in this society. And the outbreak is showing what was always true, that the health and well-being of one person impacts the entire public health.
Yes, yes. And, you know, I guess to put a point on it, what does stay in place mean when you don't have a place that you can consistently stay in? And oddly enough, that doesn't seem to arrest the tendency of police and officials from actually punishing those people who don't have consistent place to stay. So let's go to another ongoing crisis, and one that's nearing its ultimate test, the crisis of voter suppression. So Barbara, you've long fought to enhance Democratic participation here in the U.S. And I suppose it would stand to reason, given U.S. claims to being a democracy, that the last thing that would be on the chopping block during a crisis would be democracy itself. But what we saw in Wisconsin last week might suggest otherwise. So can you take us to the scene of that crime and help us understand what happened there?
It was a continuation of a crime that started ages ago, centuries ago, of voter suppression. But the modern era of voter suppression started in 2011. And what we saw on April the 7th was virus voting. You know, who would have ever thought that we would see a state so desperate to have a conservative member of the court win, they thought, if they could suppress the vote. So the governor said, listen, we got to cancel this election. We only have 5 voting places in Milwaukee. We normally have 160. We wanted to have at least 26, but we can't staff it. It's too dangerous. So we're going to cancel the election. We're going to postpone it until a safer date. The GOP of his state takes him to court, to the Supreme Court, the same Supreme Court that wants to keep itself a conservative court. So they ruled that no, the governor's wrong. He doesn't have the authority, and they're going to block him, and blocked him from canceling the election. At the same time, they weren't happy to only use one Supreme Court. They went to the United States Supreme Court to block a lower federal court decision that had said, listen, the state of Wisconsin didn't send people their absentee ballots. Thousands upon thousands of people got nothing to vote with, or they could not get it in the mail in time for it to be counted. So the judge said, I'm going to give them 6 extra days. The United States Supreme Court says, oh, no, that's going too far. Oh, we can't do that. That's violating the Purcell rules. You know, changing the policies too close to the election. Come on. We have all seen the pictures of the bins of unmailed ballots, thousands of people. So virtually what they were saying was either you stay home and lose your vote, or you go vote and possibly lose your life.
Which is an equation from our history, right? Vote or your life.
Hey, but here they were so determined that they're willing to risk everybody's life. And guess what? It backfired. People got out there and they voted like crazy. They, in fact, it was the largest turnout. The largest turnout for a primary that Wisconsin has seen in decades. People were so angry. They were like, you know, people hate voter suppression. They know that it's cheating. Voter suppression essentially, in its essence, is cheating. You know, using your political power to block people in the electorate who you don't like, who you don't think are going to vote the way you want on the vote, or are not going to vote to keep you in power. So you tip and you rig the scales so that those people can't participate. So the ideal for voter suppressors coming into this year was, we're just gonna shrink the electorate. And they tried to do it in Wisconsin, and people said, no, not only did they vote in a new member to the court and vote out the conservative member, they also passed a new initiative that will stop the gerrymandering. Remember, Wisconsin is one of the most partisan gerrymandered states in the nation. So they passed an initiative saying that's over too. We're going to put that back into the hands of the people and not into a partisan legislature. You know, if you think you're going to stop us, don't forget that when we vote, we win.
Yes, yes. I want to thank everybody for getting us started. And we want to build out from those snapshots to get a sense of how these things are playing out elsewhere, and then explore the historical, political, and policy context. So I want to start by hearing from Kai Andrews. He's the author of Back to Black, Retelling Black Radicalism for the 21st Century, and a fellow critical race theorist. So we got a better sense now about what's been happening here, but across the pond, you all in Britain are experiencing some of the same dynamics, particularly with respect to your leader, who in many respects resembles our own. So he too was reckless, and unlike our own, he paid the price. So it may be that in large part because he didn't take the disease seriously, thousands of others will suffer. Now, we can assume that utter stupidity plays a role in this. But beyond that, I wonder how you think whiteness played a role in his initial denial of a threat.
I think one of the things that we have in common with the special relationship is Trump and Johnson. In fact, my 7-year-old son has very difficulty telling them apart, basically thinks they're the same person. And if you think about why we have two highly mediocre white men running two of the biggest economies in the world, this you can only really explain this through whiteness, right? Like whiteness is what puts them in the position to be making these terrible decisions in the first place. And it's also whiteness which then kind of brings on these terrible decisions. One of the things we really look at the UK and America is that we're quite the same, far more the same in our way that our politics is, in the way that our neoliberalism is, than other parts of Europe, which is also one of the reasons why you're seeing a very similar trajectory to the disease. Britain will probably end up with the most deaths in Europe. America's probably going to end up with the most deaths in the world. This isn't a surprise. It shouldn't really be a surprise given how the countries are run and who they're run by. So if you look at Boris Johnson, again, very similar to Trump. So Trump is on there, make America great. And we had a whole campaign to leave the European Union, which is kind of based on this Little England mentality, make Britain great again, anti-immigrants, very neoliberal, talking about special relationship with the United States. So that's why he's even in power in the first place. And again, highly mediocre, not very competent, and showing this in the first place. So his stupidity is part of whiteness. The fact that you can have stupid people running countries is whiteness, right? I've been a big critic of Barack Obama, I think I'd say, but you know, to be black, you have to be exceptional to be in these roles. To be white, you can be highly mediocre and even less than mediocre.
I wonder if it makes sense to also, and I'm glad you said that about Barack Obama. I tweeted yesterday, you know, imagine all of this stuff had happened under Barack Obama's watch. And in addition to not taking responsibility for it, he actually then goes on to say, I am the authority here. What I say goes. It's just, one can't imagine that that could have happened and he still would have had, approval. I read that Boris Johnson, for example, to go back to your side of the pond, his recent approval numbers are at 61%. So I'm trying to figure out, how do you understand that?
This is why I say whiteness is a psychosis. There's no rational way to understand it. I mean, this is a man who, at the start, doesn't take it seriously in the first place. At one point, every European country is under lockdown, apart from the United Kingdom. At this point, they're talking about herd immunity, the fact that everybody just catches it, we'll all get over it. They seem to miss the point that would have meant 500,000 deaths in the UK. He actually caught the disease probably when he was in a COVID ward, shaking hands with patients, and came out bragging on TV afterwards. I mean, this is the most incompetent person ever, but he's literally caught the disease, has led to, we're in the middle of a big wave now of deaths. But had we shut down the country a week earlier, as was pretty obvious we should have done, this never would have happened. But because of the way that whiteness works, because we're now in a siege mentality, using the war metaphors, he's overcome the disease, he's our leader, people are rallying around him. And you can't really explain that other than whiteness. Because if he was black, he wouldn't be prime minister. But if he was a black prime minister, there's absolutely no way.
No rallying around.
No way, not at all.
And I'm sure we're going to get into this a little bit more, but you know, just to manage the conversation, it's important to distinguish when we're talking about whiteness. We're not necessarily talking about every white person. We're talking about an ideology. We're talking about, you know, a set of beliefs, a set of behaviors. Many of those behaviors obviously impact the well-being of non-white people, but also many of those behaviors impact the well-being of white people. So for that, I want to turn to Jonathan. I mean, you've been spending the last 5 years studying how a politics of white supremacy becomes lethal for communities of color and for poor white communities as well. So what were you seeing and hearing when the pandemic first started? And what are you seeing now that amplifies some of the findings in your book, Dying of Whiteness?
First of all, when the pandemic first hit, I think there was a moment of terror across the country. All of a sudden, people realized that they were vulnerable in ways that they hadn't experienced before. Not that everybody was vulnerable in the same way, but all of a sudden here's a virus that, at least in its initial phase, people thought it doesn't care if you're rich or poor, if you're in a red state or a blue state, here's this virus that is lethal in a way. And so in the beginning, there were all of these, for example, op-eds in places like Politico and the Washington Post. And I think there was a lot of hope that basically people were saying, we're going to realize that we need to strengthen our healthcare system. We're going to realize that we need to lift up people. Because if you just think about how the virus itself works, nobody's safe until everybody's safe. So we can't really have reservoirs of this particular virus. And so in a particular way, it was a moment where it was like, here's a structural problem. Let's fix the structural problem. And I just wrote this book, Dying of Whiteness. I spent 5 years basically studying. I think you're right what you were saying. It's not that every white person is racist, but that there are structural ideologies that tell particularly working class white people that they're in a zero sum formulation, that if they don't hold on to their privilege, that immigrants and minorities are going to come usurp those resources. And that has led to what I see as, I think it's either psychotic, as Kai was just saying, or suicidal kinds of approaches to things like healthcare and guns and other factors. And what I saw in my research when I was writing the book is basically that the kind of standard white stance on healthcare, on guns, ended up being terrible for communities of color, but it also ended up killing a lot of white people. And so when the coronavirus started to hit, all of a sudden, what I saw was the exact same policies that I had been studying. Two examples. First of all, the coronavirus was a perfect example where we could have gone in and expanded Medicaid, get everybody under the umbrella of healthcare. Trump jumped in and basically said, no Obamacare, all these kind of things. All these states that were already at risk are now not going to have healthcare. And it ties into a lot of historical stuff that I look at in my book about kind of the history of white Americans being afraid of being in a network with other kinds of people. It's the same thing with guns. Why are guns essential businesses? All these white Americans rushed out and bought guns. The gun issue is another example where this construction of whiteness, this armed white man who needs to have a gun, well, it might make them feel self-protected, but it turns out most gun deaths in this country are actually white male suicides. So all these men running out and getting guns is going to put their own families, their own bodies at risk, also domestic violence. And so all of the studies that I done in my research that were just these state-level analyses became these national policies. And in a way, it's clearly this formulation of whiteness has led us down the wrong path. And I think ultimately what we're going to see is that this pandemic is a medical problem, it's a social problem, but ultimately in the United States right now, the pandemic is a whiteness problem.
So I wonder if you would think a little bit more with us about the implications of what you just said. It's a whiteness problem. With this in mind, many of us who are on this call, who've been doing this work, you know, we're part of progressive communities. We've been engaged in politics for a long time. In that space, there is this sort of common, you know, rehearsed idea that all we need is to come together to see our common interest, to have a common narrative of the thing that is undermining our well-being, the thing that's coming, you know, to get us. For white people in particular to see that there is something that threatens us all, you know, greater than the thing that, you know, separates us. So for forever, this has sort of been the panacea that we've been looking for to create more racial solidarity, to, you know, advocate for healthcare, advocate against, you know, global degradation. We could go on and on. So one couldn't think of a better example of the thing that's gonna get us all than COVID, right? And yet, there is not this moment of, okay, I'm gonna throw down this racial stuff and come together, even though it might well be that not doing so may threaten your life. So what do we do with that now?
You know, I'll say a couple of actually optimistic things. I think there are examples in the pre-COVID period of political campaigns that have been run based on kind of a different formulation of common interest. I would urge people to look, for example, at the Kentucky gubernatorial election that happened last year, where basically there was a Republican who was, you know, supported by Trump and all these things, and then a Democrat who came in and basically just said, here's how we can all do better. I'm going to give you guys healthcare. I'm going to give you guys all these things. Bring back the Medicaid expansion. Louisiana, a similar gubernatorial race where a Democrat won simply by talking to people about common interests. And so I think that there are political examples in our recent history of political alliances around common interests. And hopefully that will emerge. Unfortunately, right now, Trump has the bullhorn. It's like Home Alone 10 million or whatever. He's the only guy in Washington, D.C. right now. He's got this whole pulpit, and he's just feeding people all this anxiety narrative. But I do think that there are examples of alliance building. I think Wisconsin is another good example. It's really about getting the word out right now, because I'll just say in my research, I met a lot of people who were very problematically racist. And if people read the book, they can see those examples. But I also met people who felt like they were just trapped in the system and didn't have another particular alternative. And so I'm still somewhat hopeful that as the virus writes the narrative, that we find some kind of common humanity. But I will also say that everything that the Trump administration has been doing right now is not just in its commercial financial self-interest. It's also to block the kind of alliances that people need to have to say, gosh, who cares what our political party or our background is? We all benefit if we stop this virus together. So I think it's important to note that how many of Trump's actions have been blocking those kinds of alliances, the kind of alliances that, you know, have been blocked. You know, Du Bois wrote about this as the kind of wage of whiteness. We're seeing a kind of wage of whiteness strategy right now to not let people come together in common cause.
So let's dive a little deeper into the historical and political backdrop of many of the observations that you all are bringing, also with an idea toward examining what is being enhanced in this moment. Not so much in terms of our resistance, that I want to talk about in a moment, but the use of this crisis moment to actually expand the reach of projects that were going forward before. And some of this conversation is about what we might have missed. I'm really curious, I'm gonna come to you, Barbara Arnwine. So you point out that voting suppression has been going on, you know, for a while. I'm interested in how little traction voting suppression got, say in the presidential debates for the Democratic nomination. I mean, it only came up maybe twice, and even then it was kind of controversial. So could you speak a little bit to this failure on the progressive side of the aisle? Why has it been so hard to actually make this the priority that it needs to be, even among, you know, allies in the progressive side of the aisle?
Well, are they allies? I mean, you know, if you don't have a racial politic that is progressive, then you can't call yourself a progressive. If you don't have a racial baseline, if you don't really have a racial justice baseline, then you really have issues. So I say, you know, part of it is that constantly what I have encountered since 2000 has been a whole politic around, don't talk about race. Don't, you know, if we do that, then we're playing the race card and white voters are gonna be turned off. That's been the entire, you know, mentality. And when I came out with the Map of Shame in 2011, people told me to hush.
And just give us a sense, what were you doing with this map?
Well, you know, what people miss was that in 2010, 25 million people who voted in 2008 did not vote in the midterm election, because some people just only vote presidential, which is a problem. But in any event, because of those 25 million not voting, 30 state legislatures became very much consolidated as conservative state legislatures. You know, and what happened was on January 1st, they started introducing emergency legislation. The purpose of that legislation was to introduce voting restrictive laws, voter restrictive laws, voter suppression laws. Within From January 1 to April 1st, 40 states had over 100 pending voter suppression bills. That's how effective they were. That's how fast they were, how targeted they were, how determined they were.
And so your map was designed to show how this was marching across the country.
Right, because nobody wanted to believe it. Everybody wanted to say, hey, you know, we got a black president. This can't be happening. The Obama coalition is forever. No. You know, they said, listen, we understand that democracy is about, you know, the governance of the people. We don't like the demographics that are coming out. We don't like that coalition. We're going to kill it. And how we're going to kill it is by coming up with these cheating plans called voter suppression laws. So that's how you got the cuts to early voting. That's how you got the elimination of same-day voter registration in states. That's how you got the end of Souls to the Polls Sundays, where people would go and vote right after church to get cars, you know, some assistance to drive to the polls. That's how you got the end of 16, you know, pre-registering people from 16, 17 before they turned 18. That's how you ended up with all of these ugly, vicious voter ID laws. That's how you ended up with all of these evil practices designed to shrink the electorate, designed to cut people out, and not to mention, in the last 3 years, what have we seen? 18 million people purged from the voting room.
And at the same time, just to double back on where we started, there is not much conversation about this, not nearly as much as there needs to be. And let's just say, you know, it predates, you know, this particular moment. There wasn't a lot of conversation about it, you know, during the last Democratic administration, not a lot of conversation about it leading, you know, into the election that gave us 45. And now, in some ways, those chickens have come home to roost. Among the other opportunistic diseases that this moment creates is the disease of enhanced policing. So Paul, I want to come back to you and ask you quickly to just give us snapshots of two different things. So now there are efforts underway to address the fact that, you know, those bodies that are most at risk right now are those who are, you know, in custody. In our prisons, in our jails, and of course, those are disproportionately Black and Brown people, disproportionately poor people. So what is afoot right now to address that crisis?
White supremacy is crafty. It anticipates and adapts to our resistance. And so earlier when we thought about the stay-at-home orders and how they might impact the homeless. In the District of Columbia, the stay-at-home order specifically exempts the homeless, but it's let them eat cake because it does not provide them with housing. In the policing context, right now, police have an extraordinary, unprecedented amount of power based on these shelter-in-place orders. In the District of Columbia, if a police officer sees a group of Black men playing basketball, they're subject to 70 days in prison and up to a $5,000 fine. In communities of color in New Jersey, the police are conducting roadblocks simply to stop cars and ask, why are you out? With the craftiness of white supremacy, its law has anticipated our objections. And what police departments are telling their officers is, don't make arrests just because you can. You need to limit arrests for your safety. And what we're seeing so far is, in fact, arrests are going down. That is good news. If we look at what happens in other countries, though, that are somewhat ahead of us in terms of their timeline on the virus, what happens is that people get fed up with the shelter in place and cops get fed up with not using all of their power. In Spain, 31,000 people have been cited for violating the stay-at-home orders. In France, 100,000 new officers on the streets just to enforce those orders. In Kenya, people have been killed for violating the state curfew, killed by the police. An African-American person might look at this and say, I've seen this movie before, and I know how it's going to end. Last thing is, when we talk about the adaptability and the exploiting of opportunities, I want us to think about a man who's been a great contrast to President Trump. I want us to think about the daily briefings of Governor Cuomo, where he inspires a tremendous amount of confidence, again, in contrast to the President of the United States. New York passed a far-sweeping bail reform bill in January, eliminated bail, cash bail, in 90% of arrests. The cop union didn't like that law. Some prosecutors didn't like that law. They appealed to Governor Cuomo. Governor Cuomo had a budget bill coming up, and he decided he was going to go along with what those cop unions and what those other folks were saying, and he was going to restore bail for 13 different crimes, and that was going to be in this budget bill. People protested, "Governor, how can you do this?" The governor responded, "Look, this bill has to be signed tomorrow." This is a couple of weeks ago. He said, "This bill has to be signed tomorrow. We could hold it up and try to address your issue, but that also means that public health won't be funded." So there's an amazing documentary about an episode in Philadelphia where the police department bombed the home that activists, African-American activists, were living in, trying to get them out of the home. They wouldn't leave voluntarily. It bombed the home with many women, men, and children in the home. There was a question about whether the cops knew the home was actually occupied at that time. During the event, an officer was notified, a high up ranking officer was notified what was going on. And there were people in the house and that the house was on fire. The name of the documentary is what the officer said. The officer said, "Let the fire burn." When Governor Cuomo, when other state lawmakers allow people who don't need to be in jail to remain in jail and prison during this pandemic, they are saying, "Let the fire burn. Let the pandemic kill those people," because that is what will happen.
I'm so glad you raised that for us, Paul, because, you know, partly, you know, because of what's that saying, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. There is this rush to embrace the governor of New York because he isn't as, I don't even want to say, he's not as out there as our president. Yet, when he doubles down on precisely the policies that put so many people at risk of this, and especially, I think it's important to reemphasize, a lot of people who are locked up are locked up because they couldn't afford to pay. Couldn't afford to either pay for bail, couldn't afford to pay for a good defense, couldn't run the risk of a full trial. So you can't be on one hand, you know, the hero, and on the other hand, double down on locking up people, knowing that what is in fact a range of economic circumstances that put so many people there turns into a death sentence. At least those two things have to be held in conversation with one another. On that note, Bree, I want to go to you in your work. What are you seeing? What are you thinking people should be on the lookout for that builds out from this moment, things that are happening that bear the fingerprints of white supremacy in the past that are now being projected forward through this COVID crisis moment?
Well, in my view, I think the status quo, not only is it a disaster, it's also unsustainable. And again, this is something else that we have known for a long time. It is incompatible with humanity and, you know, with human dignity and human rights. It is incompatible with democracy, as, you know, much as we claim to be a democracy in the United States, we know that is not true. And we know that that has been an inherent conflict from the beginning because systems of slavery and dehumanization cannot coexist with any, you know, true system of human rights and democracy. So I think we are at a point where the system, certainly the economy, you know, if we want to define the system around the economy as I often do, the system of white capitalism is in freefall. It's in collapse. We had a situation where, people have been asking for a bailout, for a rescue for quite some time. We have to remember there's a significant segment of our population who has still not recovered from the last recession, right? Just 10 years ago. And so now we are at a situation where a lot of the proposed solutions that are coming forward are not solutions. Those were kind of like band-aids that may have been effective before the COVID-19. I'm thinking of things like, you know, a $1,200 stimulus check for people. People needed that before the outbreak. Like I said, you know, people were already struggling to make ends meet. So what we really need now is fundamental structural change. The systems, the infrastructure, I mean, in both tangible and intangible ways, not only just like the culture and the ideas of, you know, colonialism and white supremacy that are dangerous, but just the literal infrastructure. I mean, the way that our school systems are designed, the way that our neighborhoods are designed, are not compatible with the future. And that is what COVID is exposing. And so that's why, you know, people like myself, we are demanding more fundamental change in this moment. We need universal healthcare. We needed that for a long time. There's no more kicking the can down the road on these issues. Healthcare should be a guarantee. Housing should be a guarantee. You should, if you work full time, your income should be enough for you to afford the things that you need in order to survive. Again, there's absolutely no justification for the United States of America being the wealthiest nation on the face of the earth, has the most resources, had the greatest amount of forewarning and time to prepare, and is having the worst outcome, right, in the world. That is a searing indictment of the status quo and of the structures and people like myself who have been saying for some time, we can't get back to normal. There is no making America great again. There is no getting back to normal. There is no restoring the status quo. There is only coming into an awareness and making peace with how the status quo has been killing us, right? And now changing that structure in a fundamental way, and let's get about the business of actually having a human rights-based democracy.
Mm-hmm. So on the notion of what we have to do to create a human rights-based democracy, I want to go back to Kai, since basically, you know, United States, UK, they see themselves as partners in this, you know, great process of civilizing the planet. Yet, if we look to see what's going to happen, at least a civilization is measured in terms of its capacity to secure the health and well-being of its citizens. The UK and the United States are on track to get a big fat F. What is your sense of what has to be more fully brought forward, first of all, to diagnose why we are hand in hand in our incapacity to actually rise to this moment? And, you know, obviously, since we're talking about histories of imperialism, of colonialism, of genocide and slavery, it can't be an accident that we are side by side historically in our involvement in these as well. So how do we bring these forward to understand this contemporary moment?
Well, I think the key thing really, like the UK and the US are the leaders of neoliberalism. If you really look at, like, one of the things with this government and what it came into power on, this kind of neoliberal promise, really, we're going to cut taxes, we're going to go with America rather than Europe in terms of regulations. Our much vaunted National Health Service, which is a universal system, was basically being offered up for sale. And one of the things that's happened here, which is really problematic, is this has now given the government an opportunity to clothe themselves in the NHS. So if you watch anything on TV, it's always NHS, National Health Service. And this is kind of a branding of, look how much we've supported this thing, which actually we're trying to totally destroy and dismantle and sell to America. And so I worry that actually what we'll have is this kind of temporary, really quite left-wing policies. If you look at the money they're spending, I mean, we're giving, I think, 80% of salary to everybody. It looks really great. It looks really left. But that hides the actual project, and the project in the UK is exactly the same project in the US. Also has exactly the same racial dimensions, so far more likely to have the disease in hospital if you're an ethnic minority, far more likely to die. And if you look at the National Health Service, which is good in lots of ways, but is also a colonial project in many ways, and it has relied on black and brown workers for the front line since it existed 70 years ago. And now you're seeing that about 75% of the deaths of NHS workers are people of color. And this should not surprise anybody given the history of the NHS. But as an example of how that the real structural things aren't being worked out in this country, there's basically no discussion of the fact that almost all the people who died in this NHS, and we're celebrating them, we're clapping them outside at 8 o'clock in the night every day, but no one's mentioned the fact that almost all of them are black and brown.
Right, right. So, you know, some of what makes neoliberalism work as an ideology is the belief that the losers are those people over there, right? Not me, not my family, you know, but the immigrants, the black people, the homeless. I mean, it's always somebody else. And you know, I'm wondering whether that is a predicate for even how people are thinking about the disease. You know, it's not going to hit me. You know, that's somebody else, right? And so I'm really, you know, when I look at Boris Johnson, I was like, what makes you think you can just go in it? Where are you getting this idea? You know what? And so you're doing something about psychosis. How do you blend that together for an analysis?
Well, yeah, if you think about it, I mean, neoliberalism is kind of like the most advanced form of whiteness. And one of the things with whiteness is this kind of really strong individual and the supremacy of the individual and the white individual in particular. So it shouldn't be a surprise that the countries which are the most individualistic, the UK and the US, are going to be the ones which have the highest toll, because it is this. It's not going to affect me. It's not going to touch my life. It will be somebody else. So some of the analysis I saw about why there are some people, when they are looking at why it is ethnic minorities who are more likely to catch a disease and more likely to die, they're talking about, let's look at genetics and let's look at the individual inside. And it's blatantly obvious. It's about poverty. It's about overcrowding. It's about all those things. Same thing is about, this is a social problem. This is not an individual problem. But we are very much addressing this as an individual problem. Boris Johnson's a great prime minister because he's so strong, because he fought through coronavirus. And the other side of that argument is, well, if you didn't manage to make it, a pregnant nurse who was working on the ward just a few weeks ago just died, actually, a young black woman. So what are we saying? She's not strong because she couldn't make it through the disease? It's the worst way to understand it, and has huge racial implications.
Yeah, and you know, the racial implications are puzzling to me that they don't get articulated more in terms of what it tells us about whiteness. So, Jonathan, is there a way in which whiteness is playing out as a protector, as a shield, as some kind of immunity?
Well, certainly, I think that if there's an immunity, it's just the privilege of the system, right? In that sense, I don't know, I just keep thinking about what Kai was saying before, and I can't tell you how much I agree with it, that on one hand, the disease of whiteness in this moment is this idea of this kind of zero-sum thinking. I saw this in my own research before the pandemic, where I was interviewing people who were tremendously medically ill, very poor white people in red states, who wouldn't sign up for the Affordable Care Act. And I asked, well, why is that? And they said, well, I'm not signing up for a system, as a quote that somebody told me, that benefits Mexicans and welfare queens. This idea that basically, even if this system might benefit me, if it's going to bring in undeserving immigrants and minorities, I don't want to be a part of it. And so partially, there is this idea of a hierarchy, right? It really is going back to that idea of a wage of whiteness, this idea that even if we're relatively in the same poor state, in the same rough socioeconomic class, there's something about being white that keeps me above other people. If red state Republicans started to say, yeah, we support Trump, but in exchange for our support, what we want we want health care. We actually want, prescription drug plan. We want Medicaid expansion. We want access to roads and bridges and schools. If they ever started to do that, if working class white people ever started to do that, the entire GOP platform would fall apart, because then the GOP wouldn't be able to do what it's doing right now, which is giving tax breaks to millionaires and corporations. They couldn't afford that if it actually had to pay for things that benefited its base. And so the strategy instead is to keep feeding working class white Americans this kind of red meat of other people are coming to get you, you know, rapists are coming across the border, or coronavirus is a Chinese virus, or all these kind of things. It's this steady diet, a kind of deflection that plays to all of these historical points. There's a history of racism in healthcare. There's a history of racism in guns and education. All the points that are being used now are all Are there like code words in a particular way to deflect, to not get white people to basically say, yeah, we have a common cause with other people. And so in a way, what we're seeing now is that kind of codification in overdrive so that white Americans, working class white Americans, and I'm not trying to get them off the hook, right? I mean, there is a lot of bias in accepting that. But I would also say that there's a lot of work from the superstructure so that the base doesn't ask for, you know, conditions that might better its own material conditions.
Yes. Well, we certainly have a sense that, yes, many of the conditions, preconditions for this crisis were always there. And at the same time, there is no normal to come back to. What I'm really hoping to hear is how you all think about what we need to be doing now to prepare for this post-COVID world, whatever that's going to look like. So, Barbara, I'm gonna come back to you, because obviously, if we don't have a political strategy, if we don't have a way of actually translating our desires and preferences into political power, then we can have the greatest plans in the world. It won't itself get us where we need to go. So what's your sense of what needs to be happening now?
Well, you know, we opened this year determined to defeat and fight voter suppression and to preserve our democracy. We had no idea that we would also have to be fighting, you know, virus voting. So what we're doing now is that we're organizing. If people want to join, if people really are looking for some good stuff to do, go to votingrightsalliance.org. And we are having Twitter storms every week, giving people information. But here's what I want everyone to do. Know that, one, your best friend is vote.org. It's headed by two powerful Black women. Vote.org. You can check your voter registration status, because remember, I mentioned that 18 million who have been purged. Not one of those people got a notification saying they've been purged. They have no idea. They all think they're still registered. And they're going to be, you know, really shocked and upset when they go to the polls and find out that they aren't. If you're sitting at home right now, if you have time, reach out to every person you think who claim that they're registered and you know they're not. The most important thing to getting someone to vote is for them to hear from someone saying you ought to vote. Voter contact systems, we need them. You can give people rise to the polls. You know, the most powerful woman in Alabama during the Doug Jones election was a Black woman who said, I don't have education, I don't have money, but she had a car and she took 100 people to the polls. There's all kinds of ways you can help people to vote, to make sure that they exercise their right to vote. Don't sit back and allow people to think that they can scare us. What we need is to activate. That's how we win.
Thank you, Barbara. I want to ask our remaining panelists what it is that's inspiring you now.
I think what this pandemic has shown is what the stakes are, really. I mean, if you look, one of the things that we tend to be comforted from here is the scale of death that happens across the world just routinely. So 22,000 children die per day because of poverty, like just on any normal day, about 9 million people will die from poverty. And so what we're seeing here now is we're actually seeing actually death is something, our lives is something that is really genuinely on the line on a daily basis, which should make us really understand what the stakes are globally, because that is how most of our people, Black and brown people, live. And so hopefully that would make us think broader, have a bigger imagination about, and to say, well, actually, how do we fix that problem? Because the global downturn, which is it's happening now, is going to affect us, but it's going to affect us in the developing world far more and increase that kind of life and death thing. So I think this is an opportunity to reach out and to kind of have a global perspective on this and say, well, actually, we really need a new political and economic system. Like this doesn't work. Like we should have known before, but we really, really, really should know now. This doesn't work for us. The Black Panther Party talked about survival pending revolution, but we need a revolution. I mean, that really is the only solution to this. And hopefully we can see that.
All right, thank you, Kai. Bree, I see you nodding your head. So I feel that you're next.
Yes, I'm definitely in the revolution camp by virtue of the fact that the people who are currently in power are the people who brought us to the disaster. And so logically, those are the people who need to be removed. And the systems that are in place are what brought us to the disaster, which is why those systems are what need to be changed. And in this moment, I'm drawing inspiration, as I always do, from radical reimagining and the spirit of collectivism. You know, I think that this is not the time to talk about what we can't do. This is certainly not the time to talk about what we can't afford, because if, you know, we have trillions of dollars to, you know, keep the financial markets going, then why can't we afford the things that we know we need, such as housing and healthcare, you know? And then just that spirit of collectivism. I choose to organize at the grassroots community level because I believe that that is the most basic building block of political power. And I think that Barbara was speaking to that and talking about how we really have to continue to mobilize and build in this moment. And that has always really looked like people working with the people that are immediately around them. So I think that the best thing that we can do is to connect with those that are immediately around us in our communities, in our neighborhoods, and imagine together that better world and build it and realize it. And this resistance obviously has been going on since the very beginning of colonialism and slavery and all of this forced labor system. And so now it's that time to reimagine where we go from here. This is not only the culmination of the past, this is also a preview of what is to come with disaster as we, you know, see the further effects of climate change and all of these other things that are tapping out. We really are at the end of the rope on this and everything has to change.
Thank you, Bree. Jonathan, I'm going to come to you and what inspires you in the face of some of the truly troubling things that you've been seeing before this moment and in this moment?
There are ways of reaching out right now that I think are important, even across the political aisle, because I think there are alliances to be made when people are desperate like this that are just harder to do because we're all social isolating. So that's point number one. Point number two is, I think for people who have really excellent social media skills, there are a lot of people running for office right now who are running from office from their living room. They're probably not very familiar with how to use Zoom or Twitter or Snapchat. And so I think there's a big volunteer need to volunteer for campaigns now that can help people campaign when they can't hold campaign rallies and, you know, shake people's hands in the old way. So I think particularly people with social media skills should really be thinking about volunteering for campaigns that they agree with and help shaping this new mode of campaigning politically. And then I think the third point is just, shouldn't just be a push to vote, which of course is vital, but it has to be also a push to do testing, you know, to know our risk and to know how we can re-engage with the world again.
Thank you, Jonathan. Thank you. And last but certainly not least, Paul Butler. What's inspiring you? What should be inspiring us?
Two things. First, the good and bad news that tens of thousands of people are being released from prison and jail. It's bad news because there are 2.3 million people in prison, and so it's just a fraction. But what we should learn from the fact that tens of thousands of people are coming home and that crime is going down, not up, that this is the kind of decarceration on the way to abolition that we must have. And this is a teachable moment because we have people coming home, again, as a response to the pandemic, and we are as safe as we would be if they were locked up. The other thing that inspires me is this conversation with these scholars and activists. And I'm inspired because we're talking about race. It would be easy to make this a conversation about class or poverty or global inequality. And certainly this pandemic is about all of those, but it's also about race. And we have to understand that because, again, with the craftiness and adaptive nature of white supremacy, the language it uses now is colorblindness. And people have said, oh, we're all equally affected by this pandemic, but we know that that's not true. And so we also have to talk about race-based solutions. They used to say that when there's a recession for white folks, it's a depression for African Americans. But when there's a depression for white folks, what is there for African Americans and Latinx people and Native people. If the Black unemployment rate is always twice the white unemployment rate, what will it mean for African Americans when the white unemployment rate is 30%? President Obama, my favorite president by far, didn't love everything he did. He was once asked what he was going to do about Black unemployment. And he said, well, I can't have a Black unemployment bill. We need a Black unemployment bill. We need race-based remedies. Otherwise, we're going to rebuild this nation the same way that New Orleans got rebuilt after Katrina. We're going to rebuild it on the backs of Latinx people and the backs of Black people to the benefit of some privileged white people. To the extent that we are now going to rebuild this country, we need to rebuild it from the ground up.
Well, thank you all for such a provocative conversation, so much food for thought. I want to thank all of you for joining us. This would not have been possible without you, and also without the time and effort of our team at the African American Policy Forum and at the Center for Intersectionality and Social Policy Studies. And now a very, very special thank you to all of the panelists, Paul Butler, Bree Newsom, Barbara Arnwine, Jonathan Metzl, and Kehinde Andrews. We invite you to join us over Zoom for the next episode in our series, this Wednesday, April 22nd at 8 p.m. It will feature Ibram Kendi, Kate Mann, Eduardo Bonilla Silva, William Darity Jr., and David Blight. More information and an RSVP link are available at our website, aapf.org. Intersectionality Matters is produced and edited by Julia Sharp Levine. Additional support was provided by Emmett O'Malley, Michael Kramer, Janine Irving, and Andrew Sun. I'm your host, Kimberly Crenshaw, and this is Intersectionality Matters.
Louis Scarsella was the greatest homicide detective of his generation.
I am the protector of these people. I am the guardian that they need.
Derek Hamilton was the best jailhouse lawyer of his.
And the lawyer was my girlfriend. It was all I had.
What happens when a group of convicted felons take on the cop who put them away?
We gotta attack Scarsella.
Come and get me.
Listen to new episodes of The Burden on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.